This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Dr. Consuelo Mukes speaks with Candice Galley, Executive Director of the Cancer Support Community, about why providing mental health support is a priority.
By having a community where you feel that you are seen and heard, can really help give back that sense of hope.
Then Sierra Club's Gianna Patchen talks about how the nonprofit supported the designation campaign for the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary.
The Sierra Club was an ally organization. We hired interns and reaching out to local businesses and saying, hey, a National Marine Sanctuary is for our local economies.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 21st, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with Book Waves with Brian Reynolds.
Hello. Today we are joined by author and musician Kevin Carber. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to be talking about your career, musical and literary, but also about your new book, The Forbidden Parallel, and an interesting twist to that. So, Kevin, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and how you came to write this book?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I'm just thrilled to be here. So I've been writing my entire life. You know, I went to college for it, but before that, I was writing. I've been writing stories since the fifth grade. And I think if there's anything that's true about writing, it's that you try to pass off your stories to your friends as much as possible. I eventually started working on short stories, and that's really where I started learning fiction, how to write fiction and craft narrative. But in between all that, I started writing corporate writing and did it for jobs and got into marketing. And I'd say the novel got put on the back burner, as what often happens with creative endeavors as you get older and you have a family and you get your job. And eventually, I just sat down and decided this was the time. And I challenged myself to complete a novel, and here I am with The Forbidden Parallel.
You know, I was a librarian, and I read a lot. I've read a lot of books in my life and written a lot, too, been published. And it's amusing to me. Listeners can't hear me see me smile, but writing short stories is probably one of the most difficult genres to do because you've got to make it all happen in 6 or 8 or 10 pages.
Yeah.
And then technical writing or corporate writing has its own demands, so... They say novels are actually easier than those other two.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think short stories is something everyone should do if they want to write a novel. And I wrote this actually first as a short story. It was my longest short story, but I wrote it, and it just kept getting longer and longer. And then eventually I thought, I think there's a novel in here. And so I started where I was comfortable, and I think that's some good advice for anyone looking to write a novel is start where you're comfortable and just keep filling it out, and I think you stick with it.
You've been very kind in getting ready for this interview, and you gave me some introductory notes, what I would call a jacket blurb. So I'm just going to go ahead and read that to set the tone as we dive into your book. A revolution is stirring in Kevin Carber's debut novel, which blends fantasy and science fiction and explores the sprawling consequences of revenge and power. That book, The Forbidden Parallel, was published by Provender Press in May and is the first entry in a planned trilogy. Kevin's band, Kevin Carber and the Parallels, released a corresponding novel soundtrack featuring 12 original compositions inspired by the narrative. Originally from the Central Coast, Kevin studied creative and corporate writing in New York and Washington State before returning to Slo County a few years ago to raise his family, where he began his novel in earnest. So we have a novel, your first novel, and it is part science fiction, part fantasy, part, I assume, from what I read of it, social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the novel and what inspired you to go this particular direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a self-described Beowulf nerd, and, you know, I basically approached this by wanting to write a science fiction version of Beowulf. And what often also happens with writing is that you end up somewhere completely different than where you planned. So that was my entry point, though, as I thought, well, I want to write my version of Beowulf. That's part of the magic of Beowulf. It gets recreated every few years, right, in different versions and different creators. And so that's where I started. And then all of a sudden, I found myself adding elements of Shakespeare. I found myself adding elements of Michael Crichton and basically, and then Tolkien, of course. And then it just sort of spawned into its own thing. I wanted to write a little bit about everything that I've loved my entire life. You know, I think you'll find science fiction, you'll find fantasy, you'll find Saturday morning cartoons, you'll find Saturday evening news. There's a little bit of everything in this book, but I think it came together in a way that I'm really proud of, and I hope tells a cohesive story.
For those that aren't familiar, Beowulf is a heroic novel, one of the first, and it dates from, what, 1,000 years ago? Something like
that. Yep, yes. It's a great story to look into. One of the few versions of the manuscript that's available almost burned, and you can actually see on that little crisps on the paper. So it's just got quite a magnificent story. But to kind of clarify, the book really is something else, and it's not really a Beowulf story. I think there's a lot of homages to it within the story, but it ended up being a completely different thing.
But there is the struggle for good and evil, the hammers and the nails and so forth. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So there's a brutal caste system in this book, and there's hammers and there's nails. The nails are certainly the oppressed people. They are workers. They build a kingdom. This is a kingdom on a mountain, the kingdom of Kulasaur. And the nails, if you're born into this caste system, you are not given a name. Your only purpose is work. What's sort of interesting, though, is that the controlling group, the hammers, they also are tools, and their identity and humanity has been taken away, too, because they are only existing to control the nails. And so there is a little bit of, I think, some commentary on identity, on purpose and meaning, and trying to break out of the systems that are given to us.
You know, I was a science fiction fan and fantasy fan for a long, long time in my younger years. And to me, one of the fascinating element of that is that in many cases they're based on factual information or, say, scientific innovations that are on the horizon. They can be seen, but they're not quite here. Fantasy itself is a lot of times an exaggeration of mysterious things we experience or feel anyway to begin with, and the fantasy literature enhances that a little bit and colors it a little bit more vividly, maybe. But this kind of a novel, to me, it seems like it could be a reflection on life today in the world.
Sure, yeah.
Not to get too dark.
It is dark fantasy, you know, and it's heavy. I started this book after finishing The Wire, if you've ever seen the TV show, the HBO show, The Wire.
I've heard good things.
And it's a great show, but it was heavy and bleak, and I actually had to add some levity to the book because it was a little too bleak at first. But, you know, it's a book about seeking meaning in life, but it's also a book about the dangers of power. And I think power seeks to separate us and control us and dominate us. And I think we see that today. It's a little myopic to even just talk about American politics because this happens everywhere. But I think American politics is a great point of that. Their whole point is to try to separate us.
It seems to me, and this my own little personal conspiracy theory, that people who are powerful, not always, but many times, they become corrupt. They become mentally unbalanced, spiritually, you know, depraved, let's say. But they want to continue doing what they're doing without any interference whatsoever, not from the government, not from the people. And so while the average human being would strive for utopia, what the powerful want to do, at least for middle and lower classes, is create dystopia because people who are fighting amongst each other, who are disengaged or cynical, etc., because of the violence, because of the falsehoods that they've been told, they're a lot easier to manage. You know, if you have a flock of sheep disturbed and agitated, you know, they're going to just scatter like leaves on the wind and not be a force to either preserve the flock or to look for better pasturage, whatever it might be. So it's always, I think, historically been in the interest of the powerful to create havoc at the lower end of the social scale, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this book and the whole trilogy really explores power as a disease. And I think that's the thesis. One of the main theses of this trilogy is power is a disease and how do we overcome it? Because what will end up happening is that, yeah, there will be a revolution in this book and the kingdom will suffer and a lot of things will change. But then everyone's left with the questions of what now? What replaces evil? And does more evil replace evil? And how do we stop that?
One of the things I studied in grad school is something called anarchy, if you will. And anarchy is the absence of stability of authority. Anarchy is a vacuum, and into that vacuum will flow the very first power source. Or the example they gave us in a class, I'll never forget it. He had a bottle of carbonated, like 7-Up or Coke or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he took church key and lifted the lid, and you hear this whoosh. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not gas going out. That's gas going into the bottle because there's a vacuum between the liquid and the top.
Yeah.
And it was just instantaneous. Yeah. And he said society is like that.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author and musician Kevin Carver, whose new novel by Provender Press is titled The Forbidden Parallel. Let's talk about your musical connection here. You've explained to me that putting out a novel with an accompanying soundtrack is maybe never been done before?
There's been some variations of it I've found. And, you know, I've seen an author kind of bring musicians together and kind of, you know, request songs and maybe release a companion album. That's, I think, been done. And I don't certainly want to claim I'm the first to do anything, but I will say this to me is been a completely unique process. And it started quite organically. It was, I call it a creative impulse that lasted 2 years. And I wrote the first draft of the novel and I needed a break from it. I needed space. And that's one of the secret sauces of writing, I think, is to give a little space from your manuscript. And so I returned to some music I had written right before. It all started kind of feeding into each other.
Let's listen to a clip from your album, Forbidden Parallels. Pretty impressive. Would you like to read a little bit from the book, Kevin?
Oh, I would love that. Yeah. So let me preface before I start. You know, I think this is an interesting passage to read because it's a little peek behind the curtain. Anyone who's written a fantasy or a sci-fi novel knows a thing or two about world building, and I had to learn as I went. And I think the instinct is to tell and almost be encyclopedic. And I think a lot of us learn probably the wrong thing from Tolkien in terms of how to do this, because he did it masterfully and then we're all trying to mimic him. But when I did it, the later in the stage I got of the book, I realized there was less addition I needed to do and it was more subtraction. And so I wrote a passage that really replaced 10 pages of just world building. I wanted to find a way that would storytell the world. So I wrote this flashback story. Our main character is named Jiri, and he's remembering a scene with his mother. As I mentioned earlier, he was born a Nail, and as Nails were not given names. So his mother gave him a name for reasons we'd find out later. And she's just explaining this world to him in a very secretive way.
So, great.
This you can never repeat. A finger in the dirt drew the simple shape of a mountain. We are told this is our world, Jiri, that all of Aru is only a mountain surrounded by water. The boy's mother added squiggly lines in the dirt at the bottom of the cone. The truth is our planet is far too big for any one eye to see. There are other mountains, Jiri, forests, jungles, flatland parallels, sea towns. Flickering, the dwindling flame of the candle post danced within her eyes. The boy cherished Mother Nell's tales. Soon he would sleep and dream, but now he fought to bury his yawns, desperate to convince his mother, and perhaps himself, that he was simply still too awake for sleep. Plan net? The boy bemused, unfamiliar with the stretchy syllables. Mother Nell often spoke in riddles, words he didn't know, sounds other tongues never uttered, bedtime myths. Jung Gal? She smiled at the boy, perhaps seeing what all mothers saw when they gazed at their sons, the very beating of their hearts, parallel souls sharing blood. Patiently, she tilted her head, looking. Information was dangerous, but ignorance deadly. And what of innocence? You will see it all, Jiri. Everything Aru offers will be yours, I promise. Are there really flatland parallels? She nodded, thinking. Cities, they call them cities, or towns. Her finger returned to the dirt. The ocean you can see from our parallel does not surround the entire mountain. Only half. The other side is what they call the treelands. In this parallel, we have only three. But here, she drew tall lines around the mountain. There are too many to count. Jiri's eyes grew wide. She continued. Past the treelands are three territories. The northern arm, a settlement above us. Down here lies the southern arm. And between both, the shield. They don't look like arms. The boy studied her crude circles. Whose arms? The reach of the Sor's kingdom. That's all. Beyond Sor's arms, there are deserts and tribes, other kingdoms, and rows of mountains, smaller but infinite. We call it the Endless Range. The boy looked away from Mother Nell, at nothing really, letting his mind wander. In the exterior district of the fifth parallel where they lived, Nails lived in long rows of shanties, a slum of huts interconnected and built atop one another. Their doors and windows angled in the floors and ceilings. In any shanty, it was common for heads to appear, like solemn weeds sprouting from the dirt. As each shanty led to another, it worked like a trail system. Some Nails would navigate 20 or 30 shanties to find their space. Others climbed through just a few. The shanties were all similar in size and space, but Jiri's was the only one he had ever seen with a false wall, a hidden room. The boy stared at it now. Mama Nail, what's beyond the water? Is there anything? He asked. Stridently, she swiped the dirt and cleared the map. They watched two Nails climb through their floor and push on to the next shanty, their weary frames bored from the journey.
Wow, I get goosebumps from that.
Thanks.
What do you think, this is the librarian talking, what do you think the role of reading is and or should be in our society? When I say that or ask that question, particularly I mean reading a print book versus reading online, because I think sort of cognitively, qualitatively, they're very different. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I'm on screens all day for work. I work marketing during the day, and then I write at night and on a screen. But I actually also handwrite my first drafts, and I try to get off a screen as much as possible. I think it's important for our eyes and for our brains. My son, who's 8, reads books all the time, and it makes me so happy and to see him doing that. I think there's something sacred about printed text. You know, something that you can hold that won't change. And the internet, as it continues, AI or not AI, it will be harder to trust anything on it. And I think there's something, not that AI can't affect the printed word, it certainly can. And obviously misinformation is printed all the time. But I think there is something sacred about holding something that will stand the test of time.
The internet, I think, is more about grazing, you know, having a nibble here and moving to another website and having a nibble there. And most print material is story-based, because that's how human beings learn best, I think. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a coherence to it. And I think one of the beautiful things about science fiction / fantasy fiction, too, is that it's like a springboard into another dimension, another consciousness. And I think it's healthy to participate in that, and wonderful. I'd like to mention that your book is now available, Forbidden Parallel, on Amazon and bookstores. Ask for it by name if it's not being carried. The novel's soundtrack is streaming globally and will soon be pressed on vinyl. Yay for vinyl.
That's right.
Pre-orders are now live for the limited edition vinyl record. And you can learn more about Kevin and stay in touch at kevincarver.com. Final thoughts.
I'm just so pleased to be here. I am excited to start this journey. This is my first book, so I welcome everyone who reads it to get in touch and say hello, and I look forward to meeting you all in person.
Wonderful. This has been Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author and musician Kevin Carver, whose new novel from Provender Press is The Forbidden Parallel. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Up next is the nonprofit story with Dr. Consuelo Mukes.
Today, I have a wonderful guest I'm so excited to introduce with the Cancer Support Community. And I have with me Candice Scully. She is the executive director of the Cancer Support Community. And Candice, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Oh, thank you, Consuelo. I'm very happy to be here.
I know we have a lot that we need to talk about. You are working with something that is so important to so many people, people that will talk about what they have with cancer, people that maybe don't, but there's a lot of mystery around it and there's a lot of need around it. So we're going to get into some of that today and let you really tell us where you're coming from. So tell us a little bit more about Cancer Support Community, how you got started, what was your inspiration, how long have you been here, all that really good starting part.
Yeah. So Cancer Support Community is actually a part of a national nonprofit that started in the early 80s with Dr. Harold Benjamin with the wellness community down in Los Angeles. He had a center in Santa Monica that focused on support groups and family support, social emotional support for families impacted by cancer. And it kind of evolved and became the Cancer Support Community. One of the, I guess, benefactors of that organization was Gene Wilder, whose late wife, Gilda Radner, was a huge proponent of the wellness community and the work that Dr. Harold Benjamin was doing. So he started Gilda's Clubs, and those merged with Wellness Community and became the Cancer Support Community. So we are actually part of a national network of nonprofits. However, all of us operate individually as our own 501c's serving the communities we are in. So Cancer Support Community, California Central Coast, we started in 2009. Out of a need, we have had a local couple who was actually both diagnosed on the same day.
Wow.
And they realized that there were needing some resources in this area. They were pretty influential. So they went and reached out to some friends and they started the organization. And so in 2012, we became a cancer support community. We are located in the North County up in Templeton off Los Tablas Road. But we do support groups, individual counseling, healthy lifestyle programs, and education and advocacy, as well as some patient navigation.
You know, it's interesting, the Cancer Support Center. You know, what exactly is going on with this knowledge and action and all of the community pieces and the emotional pieces that you actually work with the cancer community? Because I don't know if we always think about that. We think about it as a medical situation and you go in and get the body fixed up or whatever. But you're looking at things in a deeper level also.
Yes, there's been a lot of research and studies done about the mental health piece for those with chronic illnesses. And a lot find that with a chronic disease or something like cancer, there are marked increases in anxiety and stress and depression, which in turn can affect the outcome of someone's prognosis. So by having a community where you feel that you are seen and heard, where you're able to share your emotions and share those fears, as well as to be armed with tools for, you know, like meditation or mindfulness, can really help give back that sense of hope. It can make those adhere to their treatment because they have more of a positive outlook. They have, you know, feeling that they're not alone. And that's really one of our big things is so no one can face cancer alone.
You know, this is interesting because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about cancer. A lot of people feel like if you have it, it's almost like it's an experience. You have a cold, it happens, you get treated, it's over. But cancer, I think, is different. And it doesn't just go away. And I don't know that people might understand that. Are you finding that that's something that's happening?
Yes, cancer definitely, and actually kind of a summarize a quote from Gilda Radner, is a club that nobody wants to join, but once you become a member, it's lifelong. And it is. We find that people come to us at all stages of their cancer journey, whether it's newly diagnosed or post-treatment. And, you know, just to share a little personal, that's actually how I got involved with Cancer Support Community, is I myself was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 35. Mm-hmm. And I was in a place where I felt like I could not relate to my friends, and I was shielding my emotions from my family because I didn't want to add any additional burden or fear to them. And someone suggested I go to Cancer Support Community, and that was the first place I let my guard down, and I was able to really deal with the emotions that I was feeling.
So it can be a very lonely disease, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It really can. Even though I had an amazing network of friends and family, I felt like they couldn't relate. Or again, I was trying to shield them from my fears because I didn't want to install those in them. I kept giving that brave face that, you know, I've got this. I'm going to be okay. But when I went through the doors of Cancer Support Community, I was able to, as I said, let that guard down and share those fears and anxieties. And with that, I learned to address those and, you know, healthy ways to manage the stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. We offer a wonderful mindfulness program. And, you know, mindfulness is kind of, some people understand it's kind of a buzzword right now, but it really is an amazing tool to help deal with stress and anxiety in everyday life.
I think there's so many things that go along with having cancer and having it in your body, and it's not something that's just going to come and go, but that's not understood in society.
Yeah.
So it makes it hard for people to kind of relate to a person.
It does.
In their family.
And especially, you know, when you're done with treatment and you ring that bell and everybody's cheering for you and they're so, you know, proud that you've made it through your treatment. But for me, and I know for a lot of cancer patients, that's really when the reality of the situation hits, because you're going back to everyday life. You know, everybody's just, they're like, well, you're good. You beat it. And that's when you begin to realize that, okay, what did I just go through? Because when you were in it, you know, you're in the thick of it. You're fighting, you're going to treatments. You've got doctors constantly checking on you and doing blood draws. And, you know, then when it's 3 months between seeing your doctor, you know, 3 months till a scan, and then 6 months before a scan, and then sometimes a year, you know, there's things called scanxiety. A lot of people get, when it comes to time, you know, to visit the doctors and get their checkups post-treatment, if they're in remission. And yeah, it's just really, there's a lot of emotions, a lot of things that are deep-seated. So to go to a place where you can talk about that, where you can meet with others who understand that, it can really be helpful.
So let's talk about your unique programs that are available here in this community that people may or may not know about. You deal with the mind-body issues. Tell us a lot about those.
Yeah, no, happy to. So the core of Cancer Support Communities are five pillars of support, one of which is the support group. So we do offer about 25 different support groups a month. We offer our groups not just to the cancer patient, but to their whole family. Mm-hmm. So we have a family partners group. We also have a regular cancer support group. We also have a metastatic support group, which, you know, those who are metastatic do have a little bit more of a special needs and more unique lens when processing their cancer experience. We also offer a bereavement group for those who have lost their loved one to cancer. And then another pillar is a support network or support system. So we do social activities. We have things like a breast cancer networking group. We have different get-togethers. We're having a really unique spice tasting coming up with someone who specializes in spice and how they can reactivate certain parts of your tongue. So for those with head, neck, and throat cancers, it would be really interesting because they have a tendency to lose their taste, or their taste kind of becomes a little off. So this is a fun way to test different spices to see how that might be able to reawaken some taste with those who've gone through treatment for that kind of cancer.
So it sounds like you have something for everybody and at every level. And you know, you're talking about some things that I think people would never even think about their loved one or someone else they know going through when they are encountering this disease.
Yes. I mean, the side effects of, you know, treatment and chemo can really be long lasting. Mm-hmm. And so
radiation,
that's where
radiation, drugs,
yes, and you know, neuropathy, mm-hmm. you know, atrophy of the muscles. And that's where our healthy lifestyle programs come in. So we do offer things like therapeutic yoga, Qigong. We also partner with the Paso Robles Sports Club to do a 10-week cancer well-fit program. They meet twice a week, and they have special trainers who have worked with those who've had cancer to help regain strength and stability after treatment.
Mm-hmm. You know, what are some of the challenges that are facing your organization?
You know, I think what would be best is to help spread the word that we're here mm-hmm. and that we're here to help. As any nonprofit, just getting the word out. We are a small but mighty team. You know, we do have a small budget, so marketing is not a huge chunk of our budget. So really, knowing that we're there, knowing we're available, we really would love to be one of the first places people reach out to after diagnosis. We mm-hmm. want to be that soft place for people to land when they do find something out that can be so life-changing and life-altering.
So where are you located?
So we are located up in Templeton, 1051 Las Tablas Road, just down the road from Twin Cities Hospital.
That's wonderful. If you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host, and I'm speaking with Candice Galli. She is the Executive Director of the Cancer Support Community here in our area. So, Candice, tell us just a little bit more about these actual programs that are mind-body therapies. And that's an interesting idea of mind-body therapies for not only the person with the cancer, but it sounds like their support system also will have these therapies. And mm-hmm. why is that important? What is the mind-body thing? I mean, this cancer is messing up with your body, but how does that all go together? Let's let people know about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it really is your mindset. I mean, if you can maintain, you know, a positive attitude, and granted, not every day is going to be sunshine and rainbows. Believe me, I've been in that shoes. I've sat in that infusion chair. I understand that there are going to be bad days. But if you can, again, like tips and tricks to kind of help with that stress and anxiety, mm-hmm. You know, mindfulness, again, that's something I always come back to, because that was something that really helped me. And mindfulness is very similar to a meditation, but it's being in the here and now. And it's something we can practice and do daily. I actually even do it sometimes when sitting at a red light. And basically, it's just checking in with all five senses. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you seeing? What are you feeling? What are you smelling? What are you touching? And that just brings you back to the moment. So you are not, you know, in your head thinking about your next scan or, you know, what you're making for dinner, and really just help center and ground you. And so being able to bring yourself to a positive mindset, a more centered mindset, can really help with your outcomes. And again, like I mentioned, studies have shown a marked increase in adherence to treatment protocols for those who have a more positive mindset. 'Cause for those who are really depressed, they might not be as likely to, you know, do their follow-up visits or take their medication, or just basically those who have that feeling of helplessness or, you know, loss of hope. Having that sense of hope, it gives you something to, you know, to strive for and keep moving forward, because it is not an easy road.
But no, it's not. And you also work with young people, right? Do you work with children?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that we offer, which is pretty unique in our community, is we offer free individual counseling for anyone who's been impacted by cancer. We can do couples counseling, we can do family mm-hmm. counseling. But one of the things that I'm very proud of is that we also do children's counseling. We have mm-hmm. a fantastic therapist on staff who specializes in working with children. Mm-hmm. Like right now, our youngest participant is 4 years old.
My goodness.
And when she comes in, I mean, mm-hmm. she comes and she plays games, and mm-hmm. you know, they have a really great time. They're processing. I will say the majority of the children we do see are not those who have cancer, but either their mother or their father, or even a grandparent who has cancer, and they're struggling to understand that. A lot of the pediatric oncology, there is a big need for support in that realms, but a lot of our peds patients go out of area for treatment, so they're receiving a lot of their psychosocial support from either LA's Children's Hospital or Valley Children's. But we are open for peds patients. oncology patients.
That's wonderful. You know, you have a lot of programs. I'd like people to know some of the other programs that you have, like the grief counseling and the support groups of the family and partners.
Yeah. So a lot of our, you know, our support groups, we offer grief counseling. We also offer a grief support group that meets weekly. We have family and partner groups, which, you know, families and partners, or sometimes we call caregivers, they have a unique set of worries and fears too, because, you know, they are the ones who are driving their loved one to appointments. They're the ones sitting holding their hand when they're in the infusion chair. And a lot of what that group is about is filling their own cup, because, you know, you're giving so much to those that you love who are going through something, but you cannot continue to give if you're not filling your own. Mm-hmm. So it's about how they can maintain and take care of themselves while taking care of their loved ones. We also do have a lot of education we offer. So one of the things we hear a lot from our participants is they're curious about the latest in immunotherapy, or they want to know what to eat during treatment. And so we do partner up with a lot of local specialists or local oncologists to give an education series. So they're able to come and meet with our participants, give a presentation, and answer any questions they may have.
Now, are all of your programs in the location, or are there also some virtual ones?
All of our programming is offered in person or virtual.
Wonderful. Okay, mm-hmm. So you do have the option.
Yes, we have the option.
Involved with that. Yeah. Okay, so we can get online and get it through Zoom or something?
Yep. Like we can do our counseling. We have certain support groups available through Zoom, as well as our education is usually offered either hybrid, so either in person or Zoom too, as well as our yoga. We do our yoga and our Qigong are available virtual as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. What are some of the results that you've seen of people coming through this program?
There have definitely been many, many wonderful, heartwarming stories of people who have been participating with us at Cancer Support Community, one of which actually just recently happened. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a music as therapy group, and we had a local musician who specializes, he's also a hypnotherapist and specializes in mindfulness, and he was doing a three-part series with us, and we were hosting it in person because, you know, it's music, so we were singing and we had instruments and he was playing, and we had an individual, and she has been with us since 2020. So she started with Cancer Support Community when everything was via Zoom. And her and another one of our participants bonded during our virtual mindfulness group, and they have been seeing each other for 5 years on screen. And the first time they saw each other in person was at this group a few weeks ago. And just the smile, and I mean, it was like they had, you know, they'd known each other forever. And it was just very heartwarming to see that beautiful interaction between those who have been there to support one another for so long, but who have never actually met in person.
Right. It's like a family.
It is like a family. Mm-hmm. That's why community, we call ourselves a community.
That's wonderful. So what about the costs to this?
So everything that we offer is at no cost to our participants. So we are solely funded through our fundraisers, donations, some grants, and sponsorships. So there's no cost to do any of our programming.
So you do have a need, though, for people to donate,
yes,
to be a part,
do.
And
yes,
to support this. Tell us about that and how people can support you.
So we do several fundraisers a year. We have a really fantastic bike ride in the spring called Tour of Paso. It's going on its 16th year. So if you're a cyclist, keep that in mind. We usually have that in April. And then coming up is actually our signature fundraiser. It will be our 10th year, so our 10th annual gala and auction. This year's theme is Magic of Hope. So we are having a magic theme. We will have YouTube sensation and local magician Rich Ferguson there. And so we are always looking for sponsorships for that event. If there's any in-kind donations, things people want to contribute to our auction, whether it's overnight stays or restaurants, or if you're a business looking to a gift basket, we are always accepting donations for our auctions, as well as our individual donations that we accept. And then one of our newer events, which I am very excited about, is a community event. We host a walk in October. Mm-hmm. And so this walk will actually be our third year doing it. It is a family fun event. We really encourage the community to get together, join teams, or create teams fundraise on our behalf, wear their pink, you know, prizes are out for those who raise the most money or those who have the silliest team name and costumes. And it really is a fun event. Mm-hmm. So we host that out at Oyster Ridge out at Santa Margarita Ranch.
And what's your website in case people want to go there and get some more information?
Our website is csclo.org.
Wonderful. We've been speaking here with Candice Gully. She is the executive director of the Cancer Support Community here in our area and telling us about all of the details that go into us. Candice, any final words you'd like to share with us about what people should know about cancer or maybe some of the people that you work with?
Yeah, one of the things I would like to say, there are a lot of misconceptions about cancer, but cancer is, when you, after diagnosis, it is something you carry with you. And it's not something, like you said, like a cold. It's not something you just get over. So we are here to offer support at any stage of cancer. So regardless of if you're newly diagnosed or if you're 10-year post-treatment, we understand that emotions can arise at any moment. So please do not hesitate to reach out to us if you do feel like you need some additional support. And again, our programs are not just designed for those who have cancer, but for anybody in our community who has been impacted by a diagnosis.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For the special work that you do. I've been speaking with Candice Gully. She is the executive director of the Cancer Support Community located in Templeton in our area here. Get online, find out more about it, and become supportive. Thank you so much for being on The Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, Gianna Patchen, the Sierra Club's Santa Lucia Chapter Coordinator in San Luis Obispo County, speaks with me, Meher Ali, about the nonprofit's key initiatives in the community.
Welcome, Gianna. So, talk to us a bit about the Sierra Club and its history. Is it a nonprofit?
Yeah, I'm happy to share a bit about the Sierra Club. Sierra Club has a long history. They are one of the longest, if not the longest, standing environmental organization in the United States, established in 1892. So this history of the Sierra Club's work really spans a long time. They started as a predominantly like hiking group in California. And it wasn't until, I believe, around the 70s when they became an advocacy organization. So really pushing the envelope on advocating to protect these places that we love. A huge part of what the Sierra Club does, in fact, their mission statement, is to explore, enjoy, and protect the wild places of Earth. So seeing that intersection of going outside, enjoying nature, but knowing that to love these places, we have to advocate for them as well.
Interesting that the history of it started with the hiking and enjoyment of nature. So that really kind of is a personal connection to nature and environmental issues. Thank you for sharing that. So, Gianna, how did you come to be involved in advocating for environmental issues?
I love that question. I would say I had the huge privilege of getting to go outdoors as a kid. So I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington, and got to, you know, be part of Puget Sound, which is our body of water right next door, and go to the Cascade Mountains. So that set the foundation for liking to go outside. I will say, my mom is shocked I'm doing this work because as a kid, I refused to go in the yard because I was scared of bees. It was really in high school when I started volunteering at the Seattle Aquarium that got me to dip a toe into loving, learning, and advocating for nature. And the moment that sparked it for me was learning about the climate crisis more in depth and knowing that everything is impacted by that. So when we talk about public health, social justice, education, politics, food, and everything in between, it's presently being impacted by the climate crisis and will continue to be. So that was my instigating moment where I was sitting in an auditorium at the University of Washington, actually, with my fellow high school volunteers at the aquarium. And just sitting there hit with this feeling of like nothing else matters. Like this is everything. This is what I want to spend my life working on. And again, not that nothing else matters, but that everything is connected to this. And so when I thought about my future, I was like, this is it.
And when you say connected to this, what do you mean?
I mean, when we talk about the impact of the climate crisis, the well-being of our planet is tied to the well-being of people in our communities. So when we look at so many intersecting issues within our various societies throughout the world, the climate crisis is something that will and is presently touching on all of those and will instigate and is instigating further crises. So as somebody who, like, as a 16-year-old was like, I want to do something that's good for the world, that felt like advocating to protect our environment was actually advocating to protect our communities and our globe in a scale that I hadn't quite conceived before that.
So you became Sierra Club's chapter coordinator in April last year. What has the experience been like?
It has been a really wonderful experience getting to be the chapter coordinator. I am the sole staff person for the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. We represent San Luis Obispo County and environmental advocacy on the Central Coast. We work with chapters adjacent to us in Ventura and Santa Barbara, as well as Kern County. All that being said, I get the immense privilege of getting paid to do environmental advocacy work, which is huge. And I work alongside a team of incredible volunteers who really make this work possible. I could not do it without them, as well as other staff at the Sierra Club state and federal levels who helps connect our San Luis Obispo County work to the bigger picture. So really the position I often see myself in is being a connector. I'm not 100% an expert on everything, but I can know who to ask or figure out who to ask and help problem solve between intersectional community groups and issues that sometimes come head to head.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I guess an example would be really, again, where the place I get to interface the most is learning things from other folks. An example would be working with our various committees. So we have a conservation committee and a climate and clean energy committee, but also getting to work alongside partner organizations. So the Slow Climate Coalition, they are really focusing on climate and electrification throughout our county and the Central Coast. And so connecting with them, say, on an issue of electrifying buses within the city of San Luis Obispo. They may have more expertise on a certain element of that, and we can come in and like ask their opinion, incorporate our comments, bring the Sierra Club name to the space, and that kind of plays out in an array of ways here on the Central Coast. Often I'll say the Sierra Club Santa Lucia chapter touches on most environmental things here in the county of San Luis Obispo, which sounds really broad, but we engage on a spectrum of ways. So sometimes we are helping lead the campaign, put the meetings together, make sure the right people are sitting at the table. And then sometimes we are a sign-on organization offering maybe a little bit of strategic support or simply sharing it to our 4,000 plus members and supporters here in San Luis Obispo County and amplifying the work of other environmental leaders in the area. It really spans that spectrum of engagement. And the Sierra Club is such a big name. Often I see our job as like, how can we support frontline grassroots communities and help them use their voice as well? That includes individuals. So we are also a space where folks will call me up at our office and say, I got a call a couple weeks ago that was saying a development was cutting down trees and they weren't sure if it should or shouldn't be happening. So we look into it and see if that issue needs more attention than it's getting or if not, or community members who are facing pesticide poisoning and how can we help them create a strategy plan for changing that status quo.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali talking to Gianna Patchen, the chapter coordinator for the Sierra Club's Santa Lucia chapter in San Luis Obispo County. Actually, that leads to my next question, which is, what are some of the key local programs or initiatives that the Sierra Club has been involved in in the recent past?
A prime example of a project we've worked on of recent and one that's really near and dear to my heart is the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. It was just designated in November 2024, a huge win after a decade on that campaign and over 50 years of community experts trying to get a sanctuary designated for our Central Coast. That was led by the Northern Chumash Tribal Council, the most recent designation campaign. And the Sierra Club was an ally organization. So examples would be the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club hired interns to help support that campaign and helped manage those interns and make sure that the work they do actually supports it, right? Another example would be helping bring together the business community. So I actually started working on the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary campaign as a slow Sierra Club intern whose focus was working on that campaign and reaching out to local businesses and saying, hey, a National Marine Sanctuary is not just for the whales and the dolphins and the seals. It is for them as well, but it's also for our local economies. It's for our science, our education, and that local business support really makes a difference. So an example of how that intersection of Sierra Club partner organizations really is part of our day-to-day work at the Slow Sierra Club. I don't think there's a single issue we work on that doesn't in some way intersect with partner organizations or individual leaders in the community.
Tell us a little bit about the sanctuary. What will it help do? Like, what's the goal? Or now that it's been designated a sanctuary, what does that mean?
That is a great question. I had the immense privilege to work with the Northern Chumash Tribal Council and Sierra Club working on the campaign to get the sanctuary. So one of our big talking points throughout that process is that every sanctuary is unique. There's a general framework of what sanctuaries can be, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who designate sanctuaries, they amend them to meet the local needs. And that was a big part of why public participation in the designation process of getting a sanctuary was huge, because the general public's needs were considered in determining what this Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary looks like. So to answer your question, it does an array of things. National marine sanctuaries are an avenue for large-scale protection of our oceans. So really looking at preventing things like offshore oil drilling, seismic testing, that larger scale protections. Other things that sanctuaries bring to our communities are, this one in particular incorporated a version of tribal collaborative management. So creating spaces for tribal leaders to be part of the leadership of the sanctuary to some degree. It's ultimately managed by National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but there is a government-to-government relationship with the federally recognized tribe in this area, the Sandy Inez Band, and spaces for non-federally recognized tribes to participate in that process. I will add, it's not perfect. Neither are, I think right now, especially on the federal realm, we're seeing the frameworks of environmental protection that we've relied upon for so many decades being really pushed on, like, how strong are these in the face of an adverse administration, just to be frank.
That's so, a good way of putting it.
Oh, yeah. Well, just to add one more thing about National Marine Sanctuaries and the amazing opportunity we have having the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary is that even though this is a federally designated sanctuary by NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, ultimately, it becomes a magnet for community, nonprofit, business partnerships. So what we as community members across the Central Coast bring to the table brings a lot of power to these systems. So often we'll see sanctuaries become magnets for funding for research in our colleges, for programs to get K through 12 kids out in nature and learning about our ocean, for tourism and local businesses. So they really are opportunities for all of us to bring what we want to bring to our National Marine Sanctuary to the table. And I think right now is a really key time where we're, as community members, already seeing that we have to step up more than we're used to make sure that, like I said, these frameworks for environmental protection stand strong and to fill gaps when staff and funding cuts are happening on the federal level. Where can we step in and help make sure these programs remain effective?
Are you involved in the protests against the Sable Offshore Corporation and their restarting of the Refugio oil pipeline?
Yes, the Sierra Club has been actively involved in the campaign to stop the Sable oil restart down in Santa Barbara. I will add that is the Santa Barbara Ventura chapter of the Sierra Club. They are our sister chapter to the south of us. However, as the Santa Lucia chapter representing San Luis Obispo County, we are here to say that when a project like this happens outside of our county, it impacts all of us. And we can draw as many lines on a map as we want to, but especially when we talk about oil drilling and restarting oil production on platforms down in Santa Barbara, the county lines don't mean a whole lot when we're talking about an oil spill. So we have been actively participating and supporting Santa Barbara organizations like the Environmental Defense Center, Wishtoyo Chumash Foundation, Center for Biological Diversity, who are really spearheading that effort down south.
What about the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant? Are you advocating for its closure like some other nonprofits like Slow Mothers for Peace?
Yeah, Sierra Club is actively working to advocate for the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Actually, the formation of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant is what instigated the creation of the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. So that issue has been around as long as our chapter of the Sierra Club has. This has been a campaign near and dear to the Santa Lucia chapter's heart on getting the decommissioning of the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. We are at a really interesting intersection right now, since on the state level, we are seeing the push for the extended life of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant after the decommissioning date had previously been set. So we are actually now in overtime for Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. I will add, we are actively engaging on how to move forward with the pretty significant shift under our feet that happened pretty rapidly on the state level regarding.
Can you expand on that?
Essentially, a Senate bill was pushed through pretty rapidly on the state level, pushing for the extension of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. So that was a relatively rapid shift when we talk about policy decisions being made. And considering that for years prior to that decision, both the environmental organizations locally and PG&E and the Diablo Canyon facility were planning for that decommissioning process. So a postponement was a pretty significant shift when that happened. Now we're really looking at what does the extension of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant mean from an environmental standpoint. Of course, when we talk about safety of these facilities, impact to marine and terrestrial ecosystem, the fact that it's on a fault line, but also from a fiscal perspective. So what is the impact on ratepayers across the state of California? What is the impact on taxpayers and the budget at the state of California? Making sure this facility is up to date and extending its life is really expensive. And it's currently looking like ratepayers, taxpayers in the state of California are going to be holding the majority of that burden.
How can people support the Sierra Club?
Thank you for asking. The Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club is a membership-based organization. So if you're interested in supporting us, I would encourage you to go to sierraclub.org/santa-lucia and sign up to become a member or add yourself to our email list. Our membership-based organization is one way to support, but anyone and everyone can and should get involved. I encourage you to use your voice, reach out, let us know what's happening in your community, and I hope we'll see you at one of our upcoming events.
Thank you, Gianna, for joining us today.
Thank you, Maher.
That was Gianna Patchen from the Sierra Club talking to us about the nonprofit's work in San Luis Obispo County.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCPX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website, to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.